You're listening to the official podcast of Asbury University, produced by students with God-honoring conversations that inform, edify, and encourage. This is Asbury. We explore culture and current topics through a Christian worldview, promoting a well-balanced life, and we empower our community to belong, become, and be set apart. I'm your host, Abby Laub. Welcome to This is Asbury.
Welcome to This is Asbury. I'm your guest host, Paul Nesselrode. I chair the psych department here at Asbury, and I also direct our honors program. Our guest today is author and professor, Dr. Felicia Wu Song. Dr. Song serves as a professor of sociology at Westmont College. It's a Christian liberal arts university in Santa Barbara, California. She has a recent book out entitled Restless Devices, Recovering Personhood, Presence, and Place in the Digital Age. And she's here on campus as a guest of the Honors Program to give an address about the theme of this book. In our brief time together, I'm going to ask her a few questions about her book and her research related to it. So welcome, Felicia. Thank you for taking a few minutes with us today.
Sure. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Good. Yes. Well, it's great to host you. I really enjoyed the book. I found that it was relatable, often drawing from everyday events and concerns that we all experience. And secondly, I thought that it was very accessible. Even though you draw from a wide variety of thinkers, it was something that I think everyone would benefit from. And thirdly, and perhaps not least, is I found it to be so very practical, moving from these ideas to sort of things we can think about trying. So we'll get to the practical aspects in a minute, but let's start with what sort of drew you to this topic. What pulled you in this direction?
Yeah, so when I finished college, email had just come on the scene. I know that dates me. But it was fascinating to see how email was changing the ways that people were carrying on their friendships and their work lives. And so I became interested in how technology shapes our relationships with each other. But in some ways, the thing I was even more interested in was the fact that schools and workplaces and families all started using email, but we were having zero collective societal conversation about it. And that struck me as exceedingly odd. And so I happen to have read Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death at that time. And I was thrilled to discover that there were people thinking about mass media and thinking about how it affects us, not just the content of what that program or show is about, but how just our use of the technology and our mediated experiences through technology shapes us. And so that got me down the road of wanting to study mass media and digital technology and looking at how it forms us, forms our perceptions of reality. And so in some ways, the book, Restless Devices, is really a book I've been wanting to write since I started grad school. It's just been accumulating through the years, and I'm really thankful to have finally gotten to a place to be able to do that.
Yeah, wow. It's a wonderful read and very thought-provoking and sort of unpacks and sort of situates discussion in the right place. And as you're answering that question, I was thinking about how I responded to email, and I think I just responded like most everybody else. Wow, this is neat. And not really reflecting on the bigger issues that it prompted. Yeah, absolutely. It dates me as well. And there's so much to talk about, but I just pulled out a few things here. And I couldn't pass up your wonderful reference to one of my favorite polymaths, Pascal, his insights I keep coming back to. Mm-hmm. And one of them is the role of diversion in our lives. And so a quote you've used in your talk, I'll just reference one of his thoughts. Mm-hmm. Quote, being unable to cure death, wretchedness, and ignorance, we have decided in order to be happy, which I think is interesting, happy, not to think about such things, unquote. So this is one of Pascal's thoughts as he was weaving together, as we're led to believe, maybe a master apologetic for his fellow unbelieving intellectuals. But you draw on that, and I was thinking about it. And so does the fact that Pascal's picking up on this, and now the fact that what we experience today with the way in which our technologies allow us to be diverted, does that help us think about, does that help us move back from the technology itself and think about the larger, the more rooted human need there? Just talk a little bit about that. I find it fascinating.
Yeah. I think there's so much we can explore about the technology itself. We're living in an extraordinary time where each new platform, each new app that we integrate into our daily lives is introducing so many new dynamics that need to be examined. And yet at the same time, I think what's interesting is the way in which as human beings, we're fundamentally the same kind of creature that's engaging these technologies, that's drawn to these technologies. And so I think there's so much to explore that's ancient, that can benefit from the luminaries like Pascal, right? That have something to say about who we are as human beings. And if we pay attention to it deeply enough, it can shed some insight into why maybe I can't stop watching Netflix when I come home after a long day of work, or just want to sit around and play that silly game on my phone, right? When things in the world are just depressing or sad, right? It all can feel, you know, fairly mundane and harmless, right? It's not like I'm stuck on Netflix or stuck on that game. And yet there's just something about the constancy of that default, right? To just kind of say, I don't know. I'm just going to go, you know, watch this ridiculous show just for half an hour every day after work, right? And it says something about who we are and what it is that we need or what it is that we might be actually missing out on.
Yeah. Excellent. Another theme that I can't pass up that I'd like to hear your thoughts on comes out of a chapter entitled Digital Practices as a (secular) liturgy. And in that, you put your finger on the long-lasting assumption, I would argue, coming out of the Enlightenment, that people are primarily thinkers. Mm-hmm. You say, not so fast, I think you use the word appetites, desires, lovers. We have things we wish to pursue. How does that realization impact how we should think about our interactions with our devices?
Yeah, so I get that framework from Jamie Smith's work, from Desiring the Kingdom and You Are What You Love. And I find that framework to be exceedingly helpful, if only because autobiographically, I have found that even though I am spending my professional life studying the effects of technology and do all the research. I know a lot. I think about it a lot. I understand cognitively all the possible negative outcomes that can come with unthoughtful uses of technology. And yet when I look at my life, I still do the same things I used to do before I even read these studies. Like, I still do it. And so, you know, I'm sure all of us can think of the ways in which we know a lot of things about the downsides of technology, and yet we don't stop. We don't change our habits. And so that puzzle to me is addressed by this reconfiguring of how it is that as human beings, maybe we're not actually trickle down, you know, I have these ideas and I understand these beliefs, I have this insight, and then it'll just magically transform what I do with my day. It's just not the case. I mean, not just in technology. I mean, all sorts of areas of our lives are like this. And so to think of ourselves not merely or primarily as thinkers, but as lovers, as creatures with appetites, who are visceral, who are bodily, that gets at something that I think is very real. And it's hard to describe. It's certainly not as salutary about who we are as human beings. But I think it gets at a reality that is worth exploring. And it makes, I don't know, it makes sense of other aspects of our lives that we are more familiar with. You know, I often talk about the athlete or the musician or the artist, people who live in their bodies and train their ears. And you see how that training, that shaping really does form the person, right? It forms them. It forms the acuteness to which they perceive the speed of the ball or the sound of a note. And it's that kind of bodily sharpening of skill and senses that totally tracks, right, with this Augustinian view of being persons.
Yeah. As you're talking, Pascal came back to my mind again. Mm. The heart has reason; reason knows not of, right? Mm-hmm. But there's this, fantastic. Let's shift, if we can, from diagnosis and description to maybe remedy, because I think once we sort of awaken ourselves to perhaps what's happening and the time we're losing, and so we're starting to feel differently about these, and we're wondering, and then the question is, well, what to do? Mm-hmm. What to do about it? So I'm going to content myself to just ask a question or two. But you mentioned a term that I think it makes sense, but I hadn't really heard it before, counter-liturgies. Mm-hmm. Can you just tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah, so if we think about our routine digital habits as a kind of liturgy, a kind of practice that trains us, trains our desires, trains our loves in a certain direction, and if we think of it as what Jamie Smith calls secular liturgies, that is, it trains us, it forms our desires in a direction that's away from God, away from the kingdom of God, then counter-liturgies are these habits and practices that kind of push back against the normalized routines of our digital world. And so what I love about this idea of counter-liturgies is that it's not just about doing the digital detox or doing the fast or cutting social media during Lent. It's saying, hey, you know, we need to fill ourselves with something that is life generative, that is beautiful, that will truly satisfy our appetites. And so counter liturgies are these practices that will do just that. So what am I going to do with those 30 minutes that I'm not scrolling on TikTok now, right? Am I just going to sit around and just sweat it out? The counter liturgy says, no, go find something else to do that you know is life-giving, whether that is to paint or to bake bread or to go on a run or, right, whatever it is. There are these ways that we can fill our lives, so we remember actually the joy and our appetite for beauty that God has put in all of us, right? And to reinvigorate our familiarity with that.
I think I'll move from this thematic general question to get to the practical, like by no means the necessary, but sort of just here's something to try. Mm-hmm. And in your book, in between several chapters or sections, I'm not sure I quite remember, you have these little challenges for the reader. Mm-hmm. And you don't put them off as like the method, but here's something, if you're interested, here's something to try. And I remember reading one called the Freedom Project. Mm-hmm. And maybe that actually unfolds over two or three different.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I will admit with all humility that I've tried two or three times. I'm not sure I need to go back and look at all the details because mm-hmm. I know you carefully construct what this exercise might look like. Mm-hmm. And so maybe I can be more successful at it. I look back, it's because you've very kindly sort of create some caveats that seem to allow us to stay connected. But let me stop talking here. Tell us what you mean by the Freedom Project.
Yeah, so the Freedom Project is, like you said, a set of suggested experiments or exercises that can hopefully lead people to experience what I think of as more freedom in their lives with their technology. I mean, I think I'm working with the assumption that a lot of us simply feel enslaved, quite frankly, or constantly put upon by the dictates of our digital demands, even if it's responding to loved ones with a degree of immediacy, right? It's taxing in the long run. And so how can we move towards a more rightly ordered, a more free, healthy existence with the digital devices and responsibilities that we may carry? And so it moves through these stages that starts, actually the first stage is the hardest. I think it is the 24-hour digital fast, and it really is a kind of throw you into the deep end of the pool exercise that is meant to kind of shock you and say, oh wow, yeah, that was really hard, or I can't make it 24 hours. And the purpose is not, it's not a set of exercises that are meant to be New Year's resolutions or self-improvement techniques, or you're going to, you know, after you're done with this in 30 days, you're going to be free. It's not that at all. It is exercises that are meant to provoke more self-awareness, hopefully instigate some self-examination and questioning of, oh, okay, I didn't realize I used technology this much or in this way. And it guides the reader through these different stages that move from awareness to here are some new practices or routines that we can try. That I call experiments, and there is a whole range of experiments depending on the nature of our lives and the nature of our digital responsibilities that might suit one person over another. And so, again, the idea is to start cultivating a life in which we are more intentional, that we are more aware, and that we actually start to renegotiate our relationship with technology so that it becomes more of the tool that we meant it to be, rather than the thing that drives us, right? And that we have these, we've talked about counter liturgies before, that we have been we begin to build up these counter liturgies, these new muscles, or we're reminded of former joys and sources of beauty in our life that we can build up to kind of countervail whatever digital demands we may in fact need to live with.
Yeah. Do you challenge your students with this? And if so, what do they say? How
yes.
successful are they?
And yeah. So yeah, my poor students. The great thing about being a professor is you get to coerce students to actually do these exercises for grades. And so they're all exceedingly generous in complying. And I do remind them, like, you don't get the A because you actually did it quote unquote right. Like, you get the A just for trying, right? And just for being thoughtful and curious about yourself. And I think what my students find going through some of the exercises that, say, the digital fast, I mean, I think one of the things they discover, which I think is so true, is that what's hardest isn't actually not being able to text or watch Netflix or something like that, or TikTok. What's hardest is actually not being able to, say, listen to music while you're getting dressed. Right? It's just like really small, or use maps when they're driving warm. It's these really small things, and it awakens them to, oh, wow, I really do rely. And what does it mean that I do rely on these devices in these ways? And then when we get to the counter liturgies, the exercises where they're encouraged to try new things, I always find it just exceptionally joyful to read about some students who rediscover their guitar, who rediscover their love of journaling or writing poetry in the morning or before they go to bed. And they say, you know, I might try this, after the assignment. I might try to keep up with this because it's really fun. I really miss this. And that's been fabulous.
Yeah, great. And I just mentioned that I think it's named appropriately. Freedom, really. Anecdotally, real quickly, I mean, several years ago, I was traveling on the road, and I left my phone in a restaurant.
Yeah.
And it was about an hour and a half down the road.
Oh.
And the feeling that, I went back, and it was a happy ending, but I was a different person. I was obsessed with getting that phone.
Yeah.
And I think it was rather disagreeable with the people in the car. And when I reflected on that, I thought, I am enslaved. This is, yeah. So I like the framing that the title gives to this. And we think of it as a freeing device. In so many ways, it offers us certain freedoms. Mm-hmm. But, it can also enslave us.
So yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing with us your thoughts and the benefit of your research. And thank you for coming to Asbury and visiting us. She's here. Dr. Song is here to give a talk to the campus. And so in closing, just thank you and blessings on your future work. And as you serve your students at Westmont and the larger church.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of This is Asbury. To learn more about Asbury University, visit asbury.edu.